Coming up on today's Next Fan Up podcast, you're going to hear this.
And that's why sometimes stats get a little goofy, too.
You'll also hear this.
Let's not conflate the issues, right? So,
or deflate the issues? Sorry.
You're killing me.
And we're going to get into this.
I hate to use a cliche excuse, but there really was a meth head stuck in a tree this time, I promise.
Find out what it all means coming up on the show.
Listen. Hello? We go out, we hit people in the mouth.
You play to win the game.
Next Fan Up.
I want winners.
Featuring Pod Vader and the Superfans.
They are who we thought they were.
Hello again, everybody. It is Pod Vader here with another edition of the Next Fan Up podcast. I am joined by a slew of super fans this week, and of course we are going to try and get to the end of this debate of who the greatest running back of all time is. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes or find us at blogtalkradio.com/nextfanup. And there's a new place that you can find our show. Check out the AHA Radio app. That's A-H-A. AHA Radio app. It's available in the iTunes store or also on Google Play. Once you download that app, you'll be able to find the Next Fan Up podcast along as all of your other favorite podcasts right on that app. And you can listen to us in car dashboards, ladies and gentlemen. So if you might have one of those cars that the app is already installed, a Ford, a Mazda, Hyundai, there's a few others, sports cars enthusiasts, Maseratis also have the AHA Radio app right in the dashboard. Download the show via the AHA Radio app. And with that, let me introduce everybody into the show. We're going to start with our Thursday regular, and that is Neil, our Scottish superfan representing the Washington Redskins. Hello, Neil.
Hey, Jay. Just feeling a bit lonely tonight without my bedfellows there, and Justin and Greg. Where are these guys?
I don't know. I think Greg had to go do a regular job, and I don't know what happened to Justin, but Justin was supposed to be here. Who knows? But we did bring in a couple other guys to join you here, Neil. I wouldn't leave you hanging all by yourself. And let's bring in Rob, who's representing the Buffalo Bills. Hello, Rob.
Hey, Bob. How you doing?
We're doing well. We got some Buffalo Bills news coming up in just a moment, so we're going to be hitting on that. And then Davey, our Vikings super fan. Hello, Davey.
Yo.
Davey is going to get into it a little bit later on in this program, talking about the crime and punishment squad in the NFL. He's going to go a little head to head with Patrick, our Patriots super fan. And lo and behold, Neil, ye ask and it will be answered. There's Justin, our Seahawks super fan. Hi, Justin.
Hey, fellas. Sorry I'm late. I hate to use a cliche excuse, but there really was a meth head stuck in a tree this time, I promise.
Oh my. You know, last weekend there was a bear stuck in a tree right down the street from my house. So I can understand the lack of cliche there.
The worst part is, like, it's 2 weeks ago or like 3 weeks ago we had half of Seattle shut down because there was a dude in a tree. People of Washington, stop going in trees. Just stop it.
People of Washington, you can also follow us on Twitter, next at NFU Podcast. You can follow us on our Facebook page. Go to facebook.com/NFU Podcast, or you can just type Next Fan Up and you'll find us. And I mentioned all the places you can download the podcast already. Oh, nextfanup@gmail.com. That's our email address. You all apparently have forgotten about it because we would have loved some of your emails to talk about the greatest running back of all time. But that's okay. I brought in my buddies, Matt Williamson and Matt Chatham, and we'll definitely be talking about that in a little bit. I wanted to start with you, Rob, because I believe the Bills sort of dominate the headlines for the week. and not in a good way. Looks like your rookie, your first round draft choice, Shaq Lawson, who at the time it was looking like a steal in the first round, is going to have shoulder surgery after all. Right now, the timeline they are saying looks like he'll be back maybe week six, week seven. So looking like a pup list candidate. What are you hearing, Rob?
Why can't the Bills have nice things? I saw when the reports first came out, the team was quick to say he'd probably be back by the, you know, by the first week. But now more reports are coming out, not distributed by the team, that are saying, you know, it looks like he's a pup candidate. So you're looking week six, week seven, essentially turned. So obviously no training camp. So it essentially turns this year into a training camp year. And then a half hour after the news broke about him, it was reported that about 2 or 3 weeks ago, Sammy Watkins, our only relevant receiver on offense, has the Jones fracture in his foot and had surgery. So he's looking to miss most, if not all, of training camp. So, yay, go Bills.
You know, Neil is, not to get completely sidetracked here, but I saw Neil just posted in our Slack group. Neil, you can't save those jokes for private. You got to share those with the public.
Oh, I was just wondering, you know, what excuse Justin's going to have next week. Is it going to be, well, we've had a bear up a tree. We've had a meth head up a tree. Next week, it's going to be a bear on meth up a tree.
Or it's going to be Sammy Watkins' broken foot climbing up a tree. Rob,
can I just say to Robert J? I mean, this is it's surely every fan's nightmare when mini camps, so the rookie training camps, kind of get underway, and you know that somewhere. I mean, last year was Jacksonville with Dante Fowler, and this year now it's Shaq Lawson. My heart goes out to the Bills and to any team that happens to. We kind of love our first round picks. We kind of want them to come in and just be sensational, and then this sort of thing happens. So tough luck there, Robert. That was that's just awful.
Well, I mean, for us, it is what it is. We usually have terrible off seasons. I actually really enjoyed what the Bills were doing this year. So I guess we were due for something silly like this to happen. The GM, the coach, and the player all look a little silly because those reports came out right after Shaq Lawson was drafted that, oh, he's going to need surgery. And everyone was quick to dismiss it, saying our doctors looked at it. He was fine. But, you know, first OTA and not even with pads on, just hitting, you know, shoulder blocks on the football dummies, ended up popping it out and necessitated the surgery. So, I mean, it was clearly a bigger deal than the Bills wanted the public to know when they drafted him. So it just looks, I mean, it makes the organization look a little unorganized when it comes to the draft. The Sammy Watkins thing, he's only missed 3 games in 2 years, but he's always got something wrong with him. So I guess with him, it kind of is what it is. He's really good when he's on the field. Neil, we did bring someone who your team, the Redskins, just released, Andre Roberts, in today, which isn't really awe-inspiring or something to get anyone excited about, but I don't know. I guess it's someone to add.
Who is that guy again, Rob?
Andre Roberts. He was just released by Washington. He signed a 4-year, $16 million contract, I believe, 2 years ago.
So, I mean, as I look at the current Bills depth chart there, Shaq Lawson was sort of, well, I was going to get to the receivers next. I was going to let you try and deal with the defense first. Shaq Lawson sort of penciled in at outside linebacker. You do have Manny Lawson penciled right underneath him. So perhaps the Shaq Lawson injury, one that you can overcome, although you did lose a little bit on that defensive side of the ball.
Well, the depth behind there is terrible. Manny Lawson played well last year, better than I thought he would in Rex Ryan's defense. But behind him is really the only player who, I mean, could stick on the team. I mean, IK is the Nkampali, which you'll know is the guy who punched out, the quarterback from Geno Smith. Yeah, that's his claim to fame. He's good at fighting. He's not a fantastic football player. I know we covered this actually on the first pod I did with you. We talked about Corey Bierman. I'm hoping that they go and, you know, after they restructured Cordy Glenn's contract, they freed up about $7 million. So I would like them to maybe take $1.5 million, $2 million of it and sign Corey Bierman to a little 1-year deal just to kind of be the little stopgap, because that's really all that's left out there.
Well, now let's look at the wide receiver depth since you brought it up, and it doesn't look good.
No, it's not.
And I don't see a Croy Bierman type player out there waiting for you either.
No. All our receivers are 5'10 guys who are decent in the slot, which is good since we lost our slot guy to the Patriots this year, Hogan. There's just our receivers are not strong. So, I mean, we're a running team, so that's good, I guess. But you need to throw the ball at some point. So if Sammy is out for any extended period of time, it's really going to hurt us. That being said, I think we can see him back in week one. He played lights out the second half of the year last year. So I don't know. I mean, if he's out for an extended period, there's no one. I mean, they brought in Andre Roberts, but he's another, you know, 5'10 guy. There's, I mean, unless you think that you can get another year out of Anquan Boldin, there's not really anything out there at the wide receiver position. So they are what they are at this point.
Injuries are a story as old as time, but Justin, let's look at the Seahawks. What would happen if your team was in a similar position?
As far as losing people, I mean, this is a roster that's very, very deep at pretty much all positions. Some of that is just a matter of our absolute top end guys are not maybe what you consider an absolute number one. You know, we don't really have a Sammy Watkins type. So if we did lose, let's say, Doug Baldwin, which would be a huge blow, we're not dropping down to absolutely nobody. You know, we have, you know, Tyler Lockett, who can step up, Jermaine Kearse, Paul Richardson, who people have forgotten about from a couple years ago. So there's really, I think one of the things that separates the top end teams from some of the teams that are kind of up and coming is that because we have a lot of established players, we've been able to kind of build that deep bench. So it would hurt us less than it would a team like the Bills, who are still kind of solidifying their number one guys, let alone their two and three guys. I think we're a little better built to weather that kind of storm, which I think tends to show up late in the year as guys start to drop off because of injuries.
Davey, who's the guy on your team besides Bridgewater that you could ill afford to lose?
Oh boy, I think last year we proved when we played the Seahawks that there's probably one or two of them, and that's Anthony Barr and Harrison Smith. Without those guys, our defense just crumbles into just a total slot mess. You know, the two times we played the Seahawks last year had vastly different results. We sort of won one of them, even though we didn't win the second time. We basically won the second time. And the first time without Barr and Smith, it was just a complete disaster from about 2 minutes into the game. So, you know, either one of those guys, I think, are more important than anybody really realizes.
All right. Well, Neil, I've purposely left you out of this conversation because you're the guy who has the most experience with our next topic. ESPN has debuted their new site, theundefeated.com. And they opened their new site with a story about RG3. And very interesting quotes coming out of this article as they interviewed his former coach, Mike Shanahan, saying some very interesting things about how Griffin decided to go to the owner to sort of get the offense tailored to what he wanted instead of what the Hall of Fame head coach had decided was best for the team. Real interesting read. I highly recommend that you check it out. Go to theundefeated.com in the sports category and you can read the story about RG3. But Neil, as a fan of the Redskins, I'd love to hear a little bit more about your opinion on this.
I think, first of all, we are talking about the same player. We knew the player as RG3 and out. Is that the same guy?
Yes.
I mean, you're right, Jay. It's an excellent article. Jason Reed used to work for the Washington Post, a terrific writer. And it's probably one of the first stories we've seen which it probably has quite a good balance to it. I think there's the in the situation with Griffin, they're always we always kind of knew as Washington fans that there was definitely two sides to the story. And one of the things that stands out in the story is very sadly the role of Dan Snyder. And let's hope that after his experience here with Griffin and this sort of connection between the star player and the owner, let's hope that he's learned his lesson and that's not something that's going to be repeated. He did the very same with Clinton Portis some years before, where Portis basically did whatever he bloody well wanted. Sorry. And because the owner, because the Snyder just said, yeah, do it wherever you like. Shanahan obviously aware of Griffin's relationship with the owner, and interesting comments that Shanahan really wasn't keen on the trade in the first place, and because really they hadn't seen enough on tape to warrant that sort of compensation going to the Rams. And I think again that's been a rumor that's been out there, and it's good to see a little bit of fact around that. I believe Griffin didn't take part in this interview, and that's probably the right thing for him to do. But what becomes clear when you read the story is that he actually wasn't really involving himself with guys like Doug Williams, a really outstanding quarterback and a guy who broke many barriers along the lines of ethnicity. In the league, you know, I think he was the first black quarterback who won the Super Bowl. And, you know, to have him along the corridor from the changing rooms and not take his advice on how to be a quarterback in the professional league, very poor. And there's lots of criticism of his preparation. It's a depressing read as a Washington fan, but it's not an unexpected read. There's nothing really surprising there. You tend to think, yeah, this is what we thought. That's how it went. And I think most Washington fans would probably wish our G3 well. He's got a lot of ability. He looks fantastic in practice. It's only when some guy comes running at his face and tries to hit him that everything just tends to go wrong. So, yeah, but an excellent article.
Yeah, the article gets into the close-knit group of retired African-American quarterbacks. That includes Warren Moon, Randall Cunningham, Donovan McNabb, and Doug Williams, as you mentioned. And in this article, Warren Moon talks about the close relationship he has with Russell Wilson. Justin, you think that relationship is one that's been, I mean, obviously you can see it as positive, but I'm wondering how much is this relationship overrated?
It's hard to say. I mean, you know, my respect level for Warren Moon is incredible. He's a guy who I think legitimately could probably own every single record in the NFL if it wasn't for built-in racism that's forced him to spend a huge chunk of his career in Canada before he got a shot to prove he was a Hall of Famer down here. So, you know, his experience and his knowledge is absolutely tremendous. That said, I think Russell Wilson is kind of very much sort of his own kind of man. It's kind of a self-starter, does things sort of his way. And he has this very, very carefully crafted image, everything he does, all these off-the-field things he gets into. And I don't believe that those come from Warren Moon or from really anybody else other than Russell Wilson's tight group of advisors and friends that he kind of grew up with. So I think that the influence of somebody like Warren Moon, at least in the case of Russell specifically, is nothing but positive stuff, because it's really all about kind of the on the field and some sort of general wisdom. None of the few knocks that people have against Russell Wilson, I think, have anything to do with a relationship with somebody like Warren Moon.
And Neil, I think you could agree that, you know, Warren Moon is in a different class than Doug Williams. I think you could agree all those guys, Warren Moon, Donovan McNabb, Randall Cunningham, are in a different class than Doug Williams.
Oh, absolutely. I think Doug Williams did a specific thing for us. He won us a Super Bowl in a fantastic season. Yes, but he also suffered a little bit from what Justin was saying about Warren Moon in terms of getting his chance in the league. He was a good quarterback. But more importantly, he's somebody who knows the Washington Redskins franchise. He knows the history. And you, unlike Russell Wilson, I think RG3 suffers from a lack of self-awareness. He must have, somewhere, he must have known that things were not going well, either through injuries or through performance. And it's at those times you would expect somebody to say, yep, I need a little bit of advice and where do I turn to? And maybe he just wasn't turning to the right folk, but something definitely missing there in Robert's game.
You know, Robert, you've got a couple of quarterbacks in Tyrod Taylor, EJ Manuel. And as I read what Mike Shanahan had to say about RG3 and how Griffin wanted to sort of change himself from being that elusive running quarterback into more of a pocket passer, I do think of the guys that you have up there in Buffalo. But what's interesting about this as Shanahan goes on is he just had the best year for a rookie quarterback in the history of the game. You got selected to the Pro Bowl. We went to the playoffs. We tried to get him to slide. We tried to get him to throw the ball away. If he had told me he was hurt, I would have taken him out of the playoff game. To hear him do all the things that he was doing, it was really incredible. Do you think Tyrod Taylor would get away with doing that right now if he decided to walk into Rex Ryan's office and say, hey, I need to change some things about the offense?
No, not at all. And when I read the piece this morning, and I mean, the thing that just kind of jumped out to me is just if he's able to, after 1 year, go and, you know, talk to the owner. And from the piece, he was using a lot of the same verbiage that the owner used, you know, in the word unacceptable and things like that when he was talking to them and demanding, you know, that they change play calls and scheme protections and things like that. Like, just the culture that sort of thing where you can go above your boss so easily is super weird. I just thought, you know, and I mean, it's terrible long term for a franchise because it's just, and apparently, you know, like Neil said, he did it with Portis. You know, as soon as he, you know, finds a player that he's kind of enamored with, it seems like that's something that's, you know, kind of in his wheelhouse to kind of, and it just creates, to me, just creates a bad culture for the team. And, you know, I mean, I definitely don't think that's something that any other NFL franchise would be doing. I think, you know, I don't know, it almost feels like it's a fanboy who owns an NFL team and this is the repercussions of that.
I think it's very difficult to fully comprehend just how massive Robert Griffin was in Washington and with the fan base and with the team after that 2012. And even, you know, from the moment he was drafted through that first season, it was like all our Christmas presents of all time had all come at once. It was incredible. He was the future. He was going to drive us back to the Super Bowl. He was so massive as a presence at the club that I think it's difficult to compare him with a you know, with Bridgewater or Tyrod Taylor. It was just a phenomenon at that time.
Davey, how would this go over in Minnesota if Teddy Bridgewater tried to pull this?
You know, it's really hard to say. Right now, everybody's kind of seen, we're similar to the Bills, in fact, in the sense that we've gone through such a roller coaster of quarterbacks over the last, I don't know, pretty much my whole lifetime, so 30 years. So we're pretty impatient with this kind of thing. And I feel like, you know, right now everybody looks at Teddy as a really upstanding young kid. And I think that it would be pretty disappointed. And I don't know. I don't think that it would be too different, frankly.
Yeah, it's a very interesting article. Highly recommend you all check it out, especially if you're in Cleveland. Have fun. Enjoy that. I mean, honestly, I don't think Tom Brady could walk into the office and be like, yo, this is how it's going to work. But beyond Tom, I mean, maybe Aaron Rodgers. Yeah, maybe. I don't know.
Do it when you're at that level. Right?
I just
like,
don't
if
think
Aaron Rodgers walked in and did something like that. At least he has a case that he knows what he's talking about. But when you're young and haven't really proven much yet, I think it's you just got to shut up.
Well, I mean, so to me, the perfect example is when Gary Kubiak came to Denver, Peyton freaking Manning started running the Gary Kubiak offense, not the Peyton Manning offense. Like, it doesn't matter who you are or how many pelts you have on the wall. You know, you run the system. It doesn't matter if you're a one-year superstar. You shut up and do your job.
That's an interesting article. I recommend you go read it, theundefeated.com, if you haven't already. Let's get into the greatest running back of all time with my friends Matt Williamson and Matt Chatham. All righty. So, as we mentioned at the beginning of the show, last week we brought up the topic, greatest running back of all time. Who knew it was going to cause so much controversy? So to try and lay this topic to rest, although I highly doubt we're going to do that, I brought on two of the guys who helped contribute to the conversation last week. Now they're here to actually voice those opinions. And I will start with the 100% healthy one. At least I think he is. That's Matt Williamson. He's the co-host of the Dino Blueprint podcast. M-Dub, how are you?
I'm great. Good to talk to you again, buddy.
Always good to have you on, and always good to have this gentleman on. He brings us the player perspective. He is the founder of footballbyfootball.com and host of the Football by Football podcast. That's Matt Chatham. Hello, Matt.
Hey, good to be on, somebody.
Now, as we're talking about the greatest running backs of all time, Matt is laid up with an injury. I have a broken ankle, and M-Dub, I don't know if we'd put you at the running back position if we were starting our football team.
No, more of the blocking tight end role, I would say.
So you'll have all of that to take into account. Our poll, we ran a Twitter poll. We ran a series of polls, actually, after last week's show, which we did with Chatham's compadre, Brady Papinga. And out of the four polls that we did, the top four finalists for greatest running back of all time were, in no particular order, LaDainian Tomlinson, Barry Sanders, Walter Payton, and Jim Brown. And so I will let M-Dub, you let us know your opinion. Who is the greatest of all time?
That is very easy. I mean, I think it gets complicated after number one, to be very honest. And my suggestion is Jim Brown. I mean, I think that one is an easy one, like I said. And the way I think you have to look at these things at all sports, and especially football, because times have changed so much, was, you know, let's judge Danny Koufax's great ERA against what was the average ERA of the day. You know, an example I use around here is, to me, Jack Ham, I'm a Pittsburgh guy if you forgot there, Jay, but, you know, Jack Ham is one of the all-time greatest 4-3 outside linebackers of all time. He couldn't get in a camp today. You know, I mean, so it doesn't mean that he wasn't great or doesn't belong on the list, because for his day, he was the best at what he did. Jim Brown is not only that, but he could easily play today. And what I look at with him is he retired as league MVP. He was the best player in the league basically from start to finish of his career. And maybe more importantly, what people don't realize nowadays, and I tend to favor the newer guys over the old whenever we have these conversations, is he was 250-ish pounds when his offensive linemen were about the same size. So let's say somebody was coming out of the University of Syracuse this year in the draft that was a 300-pound running back that ran a 4.25 and was the most competitive guy in the field. He'd be kind of sought after.
MC, I know you have a difference of opinion.
I do. Well, first I'll start on the thing about the list that you got from your listeners, sort of the poll question stuff. And I feel, even as a guy who played in, I guess, what would be called the modern era, I'm a little surprised that the guys like O.J. Simpson and, you know, even like Eric Dickerson, and some of those guys just tend to get overlooked. That always kind of shocks me, because, you know, I guess if at the end of the day, as a linebacker, anybody that has to play that game, I think when you start talking about running backs, basically what you're boiling it down to is how hard do they get on the ground? I mean, it's really, yeah, we can talk about all these other things, but invariably when you're saying who's the best running back, who's the best at running with that ball and not, you know, have other guys put them on the ground? I mean, that's really what it is. So invariably, I think we sometimes will focus on other things. That's why I use that Craig Biggioing. I can't even say the word myself, but that notion of sort of, you know, long time compiling of pretty good stuff, and being sort of dissuaded to think that that is, you know, is really what it's all about. I think at the end of the day, provided the window is not just too small, like a Gale Sayers kind of situation, or even an Earl Campbell, where, you know, there's just the durability really should be part of the formula, but not all. But I am a little surprised that a lot of those sort of mid-generation guys that are modern, but more 80s and 90s backs kind of get overlooked. So that shocked me a little bit on the front end. But the reason I sort of define it when we say best, and I think the reason Jim Brown jumps to mind for a lot of people is because he was the most dominant running back relative to what he played with. But I think football is just such a unique sport. And I should put this sort of all my cards on the table, because I think it's really in all football sort of debates of this kind, I think greatest, and I do this even with my own teammate, you know, Tom Brady, people talk about, is he the greatest quarterback of all time? I'm not even willing to go past greatest of his generation, because I just don't think you should compare people to people they didn't play with or against. I just don't. Montana dominated his generation. Tom's dominated his. So I think it should be done that way with the backs as well. I'm saying greatest back ever. The reason Jim Brown has the yak that he has, the reason that he has that over 5 yards per carry, the reason he has the numbers he compiled, is because the people he were running against were often smaller than him. Now, to do that in today's game, he would have to be about a 275 to 280 pound back. He isn't. He was just before his time. So I don't think it's fair to even pull him into this conversation, because, quite frankly, he would be very good today, of course, his running skill. He's an aggressive guy. But he would not have had that kind of success in today's game. He'd be a very good player. He'd probably be a Pro Bowler. He might even be the best back in today's game. But it's just not fair to guess, because, quite frankly, when you watch his film, the athletes around him are far inferior. You got 210 and 15-pound linebackers, tiny little cornerbacks. Most of the missed tackles are because the guy's just not big enough. I think you could take a guy like Jamal Lewis was the example I used online. Guys I played against, Brandon Jacobs, Jamal Lewis, those guys, you stick them out there, all of a sudden, they're the greatest back in the world. I mean, they would walk through a 210-pound linebacker. It's just, I've seen it happen. So all of their yak numbers they now carry into perpetuity are because of what they played against. So it's very difficult to judge one of the next. So that's why I would say Jim Brown, definitely the most dominant back relative to who he played with. But as far as guy with the ball in his hands, hardest to get on the ground with all of the things being equal, I don't think he's that guy. And I think that's actually very clear when you pop the film on. At that level, it's probably either Barry Sanders or Walter Payton. So I'm really the fence sitter on those two, because it's more of a stylistic question. But that's why, again, I just don't think we should go there, but we did. So I really think he's the one that's kind of a easy one to keep out of the combo.
So let me just heighten what M-Dub had said earlier, as sort of Jim Brown played at the time where he was light years ahead of the competition that he played. As we look at the modern day, there really hasn't been a player that sort of eclipsed the way that Jim Brown eclipsed his talent. Is that sort of what you're saying there, M-Dub, in a nutshell?
Yeah, and I think Matt had very good points, too. I mean, you are comparing apples to oranges, but I think the only way to have this conversation is go of what you know. You know, compare, you know, who Babe Ruth was hitting against as opposed to who Barry Bonds was hitting against. You know, I mean, and of course, it's massive apples to oranges. I mean, it's watermelons to freaking bowling balls. I mean, they're not even close. They're not even the same genre, really. But if you do take Jim Brown out of the conversation, and he is sort of the outlier, just because of the era he played in, Matt had a really good point. I mean, Eric Dickerson, O.J. Simpson, I consistently say whenever you talk about all-time great running backs that O.J. and Earl Campbell, and Campbell didn't do it super long, are two that don't get the credit they deserve. And maybe because of, you know, if it doesn't fit, he can't acquit if it doesn't fit. You know, I mean, I think some people might hold that against O.J. just a little. But just to what they did on the field, he's been spectacular. I'm on the fence, too. If you take Jim Brown out of the conversation, it's Sanders versus Payton to me. I lean towards Walter, probably because I'm always going to lean towards the more physical guy. My fourth guy was Marshall Faulk. My fifth guy was LaDainian Tomlinson. And then after that, I was in the Emmett, Dickerson, and actually Adrian Peterson conversation for that, like, 6 through 8 area. I think Peterson's going to be in this conversation when it's all said and done.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I often gravitate to when you talk about, and again, this is sort of more watching it, I guess, as a player, and you try to judge a guy not just on the outcome, but how much he was a player in the outcome. You know, if a play is blocked for 8 and he gets 8, awesome. Some of these great players, you block him for 8, they get 12. Awesome. Again, it's the guy that sometimes when it's blocked for 6 and only gets 4, and that's what, and you brought up Adrian Peterson, and sometimes he's a guy that I don't think his vision is where, you know, your Jim Browns are, you're definitely not Barry Sanders or Walter Payton or some of those guys, but his just freakish skill, I think, makes up for some of the mistakes he has. And I think he's a guy that has way too many negative runs. Pod, I heard you talk about this on the last show, where, you know, Barry Sanders has this as well, but Barry's was more of an issue of his guard and tackle are 4 yards deep. He's reversing field and going, you know, 18 yards. You know, this was a little different situation, but I think the frustration.
But his minus two runs took like 7 seconds.
Exactly. It's an entire commercial. We're going to go to commercial. Barry's going to be done here shortly. But the frustration sometimes with watching Adrian Peterson. I mean, and again, I think he's the best runner clearly right now, or at least in the first, you know, first tier or two. You know, he's hard to judge because he doesn't really have a out of the backfield kind of game, but he's hard to judge with those other guys, because I think what makes all those other guys special is if those yards were blocked for, they got them. And what made them great was the surplus they put on them. And part of that was a function of vision, you know, the ability to actually see how it would play out, be patient enough to allow those things to happen. Then the next step to that is, what do they do when contact comes? Are they able to avoid it with sweet feet? Are they great with stiff arms? Do people just roll off them because of strength? Do they play with great leverage? All those things that happen once a tackle is imminent can kind of tell you more about a guy. And then after that, it's just that breakaway speed. The guys have the ability to really finish things off. And again, that's why sometimes stats get a little goofy too. I mean, a guy that breaks one and you happen to have started the down and distance on a 30 and ends up being a 30-yard touchdown, well, all that kept it from being 60 is more yardage. So it's a 30-yard breakaway where there's no longer to go. Is that somehow worse or than a 60? I mean, that's where I get a little dicey with the stat stuff. But for that reason, I think guys like Adrian Peterson sort of sit a notch below. He's very frustrating, I think, for even fans. And again, I come from Iowa, so a ton of my friends are Vikings fans and talk about this quite a bit, where he's got a lot of mundane runs that you wouldn't see out of a lot of these other elite guys we're talking about, where, man, it looked like there was a little bit more in there. But all those things said, with one, when he catches the hole, there's probably never been a guy more dangerous in NFL history. You might be more dangerous once he finds it than any of these guys on our list, because when he hits it and gets it, good Lord, it's a stallion out there. It's kind of more sort of like OJ with old USC track stuff. So that's what's rare. I think when we talk about Walter, we talk about Barry, we're concentrating on guys who really did it all very, very well.
Matt, I want to touch on just Peterson a couple more tidbits. And you brought up great points. I also think he has two other negatives that don't get brought up enough. And, you know, when you're comparing him to Tomlinson, he's not that much. I mean, Peterson's not much of a receiver. And in today's day and age, that's a major negative. He's always been a fumbler. However, I think that, you know, your negative run comment is a good one. But even if you were the most diehard football fan during Walter Payton's era, you didn't see as many carries. You know what I mean? They didn't play Thursday night, Sunday night, you know, all day Sunday, Monday. There was no red zone channel. You know, like, you and I have seen way more Adrian Peterson runs than anyone on this list or anyone we're talking about. So, of course, there's going to be, you know, negative ones where, you know, back in the day, somebody watched SportsCenter in 1983 and were like, you know, boy, this Dorsett guy's pretty good. Well, you don't see him get bottled up and, you know, all the mundane runs. But one other note about Peterson, I did recruiting at Pitt and Akron for like 3.5 years, and I watched a bazillion million, you know, high school tapes. And I remember watching Peterson's highlight tape, and he's the one guy that I thought, and this isn't really relevant as to where he belongs all time, but I thought as a 17-year-old kid he could play in the NFL right now. And I never thought that about anybody else.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting point. I think that was something that was pretty commonly said back then, like that this is one of the first people who probably could physically make the jump when they're that body should be that premature, but his isn't. I just think, actually, I did a study on Adrian Peterson this year for my Fox Sports Game of the Week column, and then we also run it there on FBF. And it was sort of, you know, hey, this is the guy that's leading the league at the time. Hey, he's got the big matchup. I think it was maybe a Packers week or something like that, and it was going to be Fox's Game of the Week, so that's what we were concentrating on. So I went back and did sort of the game study from him for, you know, three or four games that were recent against schemes that would be similar to what he was going to see that week. Now, in doing this, I played against Adrian Peterson, so I kind of knew that this was what I was going to find because it was the criticism from the other coaches. He was the, don't let him get started, guys. Just don't let him get started.
Yeah.
He's not elite behind the line of scrimmage, not by any mention. I mean, there's a lot of backs in the league that find it better than he does. But good Lord, if he doesn't have to break stride and he gets into the second level, he's as good as anyone. But that's where you come at from the, hey, there are a lot of mundanes. There's a lot of times where there might be more than he gets. But I guess in doing the study this year, one of the things that I saw a lot is sort of my aggravation with turning football into a stats game. It's the way he nets out. I mean, his gross number will come out and it'll be crazy. Like, he ends up with 162 on the day. There's 167-yard run. There's another 38-yard run. And then there's a whole bunch of twos and threes that could have been fours, And so I just as a player, often gravitate towards that guy that if he averaged 4 or 5, it's because he got 4 or 5 every time, and most of the time only 2 was blocked for on them. Now, you might spike a bit, yard on the end of it, because after 30 carries, or he had 135-yard run or something like that. But I think we always gravitate as players towards the guy that is a down-in, down-out kind of theory.
And I'm sitting here looking at the all-time list, and I'm wondering who fits that criteria the best in. I got to think it's Peyton.
Probably Walter, yeah, and that's why. I sat right on Walter and on Barry. And this is more back to the apples and oranges thing. I mean, if we can do this with John Havlicek, or as a free throw shooter, or if Reggie Miller as the 3-point line. I mean, generally speaking, the line stayed the same regardless of the era. All those changes, maybe the hand that's in his face when he's shooting it, the hoop always stayed at 10. You can judge it that way, but the Lions were so terrible for so many years, and he was working with so little. It's just really, really hard because he had so many bad runs, and he had a lot of these. I bet you his play-by-play breakdown would look a lot like Adrian, as we're talking about. But I think in his case, it wasn't for lack of vision. It was for lack of opportunity. So I think about this, and this is going sort of swinging back to Jim Brown and why I don't think he should be in the conversation. Like, in his situation, it's like it'd almost be like having a conversation about the best dunker ever. He dunked on 9-foot rims. I have no idea what he'd do on a 10-foot rim. You salute him for as amazing as he was on that 9-foot rim. But now, once we're talking about the 10-foot, at least if you're talking about everyone dunking on the same rim, you can sort of have an even comparative study. With these backs we're talking about, and then I say that, and I'm saying, okay, let's try it in football. Then you look at the backs and, gosh, one team is terrible on their offensive line. This guy, you look at DeMarco Murray last year. They're running stretch runs where he has to run 8 yards sideways before he's allowed to take a downhill cut. And it's like, I saw this guy do this exceptionally well a year ago. That's not this guy. So, the guy didn't change. It's just the scheme and the opportunity that he had, sort of the situation he was in. So even trying to make it on the same season, same era, play-to-play, it doesn't make for a very good comparison. At the end of the day, I know I've talked to circles here, but I basically don't think it's even that easy to compare running backs, quite frankly.
Matt, I love the question for you, and I don't mean to jump in, but if we set Brown aside, if Peyton and Sanders are your 1 and 2 in any order, who's your 3?
Is Marshall in a heartbeat. And the reason there, and that was my old vote. The reason I think Marshall's there is because he's changed the game. And, first play I had of any note in the NFL was as a rookie free agent in 1999 with the Rams. And we're just rolling guys through in our big team mini camp. And I'm playing Sam linebacker, and, we're 3-on-2 on the back. This is still Trent Green, still the quarterback there. And I'm out there with a couple of the guys, and, we're just – you're 3-on-2 in the back. So, you've got the fullback and back, and comes out my way, she's mine, right? And you're getting that sort of lock call. You're looking over the linebacker, and he comes our way. And they split backs. One goes the other way, one goes your way. You got to take them. And Marshall to the flat. And, at that time, it's just number 28 in a blue practice jersey. You don't know anything. But Trent floated one a little bit on an out route, and I undercut it, picked it off, ran it back in practice. And I just remember my coach coming over and being like, you know who that is? And I was like, actually, I didn't. I don't realize what just happened. And at that point, he's like, Marshall bleeping, fuck. I was like, okay. So then we got to watch this a little more closely. And then, now from that point forward, he's like, all right, buddy, you think you got me. And, now any other time I got him in man-to-man situations, he's putting it on. he's sticking a little harder, pushing off at the top of the route. He's so quick. And all of a sudden, it's like, okay, now I'm getting the full Marshall, and you know, that this guy is sick. So then it gets your attention as a young player. So then I'm watching him throughout, and I get released by then. I'm with the Patriots, and then that was really sort of his surge. When he had left the Colts and went there, all of a sudden this notion that the guy, running back, doesn't just have to stay, you know, 6 or 7 yards deep and have played with a fullback. And that is different. That's why in looking at your list, Matt, from this recent column within the present day top 10, it's why guys like Le'Veon Bell, it's why even like Jamaal Charles, it's why I think these guys are considered Deion Lewis, I mean, which is further down your list, but that's why these guys are considered so dangerous. If there was no Marshall, who knows if a coordinator's using guys that way.
You just referenced a list that M-Dub had printed on Today's Pigskin. Go to todayspigskin.com. And, of course, if you follow M-Dub on Twitter, at WilliamsonNFL, I'm sure there's a link directly to it. One more quick note on a running back that you guys haven't touched on yet. You did mention his name, LaDainian Tomlinson. As our Steelers superfan was trying to put some sort of categorization and looking at statistics, I think LaDainian Tomlinson goes a little unnoticed when we do talk about the greatest. And using the statistic of having 14 touchdowns, 80 rushing yards per game, and a total of 1,500 yards from scrimmage, at least, LaDainian Tomlinson had six such seasons. Sanders had four, Emmett Smith had four, Jim Brown had four, Sean Alexander had four. Marshall Faulk, who you guys just talked about, only had two. So LaDainian Tomlinson's a guy who perhaps played a little bit better than we even remember.
I totally agree. I mean, to me, he's my fifth guy. You know, we talked about our top four. Faulk was also my fourth. And then it goes to Tomlinson. And then I start to search a little bit for the sixth guy. So, you know, when I had this conversation on Twitter the night you guys, you know, did the first recording, a lot of people wrote me back saying, boy, thanks for putting LT in there. People never talk about him enough. And I kind of realized that they're right. And I don't understand why. I mean, to me, as great as Curtis Martin is or some of these other guys that are really high on the list, Tomlinson's just better. I mean, highlight film, being able to, you know, do things that other backs can't, receiving skills, certainly not timid between the tackles or a finesse guy by any stretch. Great player.
Played with Lorenzo Neal, so, you know, he's got T-Rex in front of him, just a big neck roll, you know, hammerhead kind of fullback. So he played in that style. So I think that allows it to be a little bit convertible, if you want to talk about comparing them to an 80s or 90s back. I'm of the mind that LaDainian's probably a top 10, but I put him in that, you know, in that sort of category of he accumulated quite a bit. He is my old sort of initial standard of how hard is he to get on the ground kind of thing. He's probably in that sort of poor man's, I hate when they use that sort of prefix, the poor man's Barry Sanders. So I'm trying to think of another way to say it, but he's sort of a Barry Sanders light in regards to just the ability to put you on a highlight, you know, just leave a guy in the dust. I'm sure you remember this pod. We traveled out to San Diego years ago, and there was a highlight that got Tim Dwight actually signed to our team. Tim comes flying from behind the play. LT catches a little check down in the left flat nearest our bench and cuts, makes a little move on, I hope he doesn't think this is me throwing him under the bus, but Ted Johnson, I think it was TJ, was at the middle linebacker. You know, Ted's a hammerhead guy. You're not going to want him out there in coverage on those guys. Put it out there as well. But he made sort of a little shake move in the middle of the field, one of those classic LT kind of things, and left the guy in dust. And then he cuts across the field, and from out of nowhere, Tim Dwight looks like he's running a 40-yard dash, like a track and field kind of thing. Starts passing people and then passing LT and making the block out in front. I want to say on maybe Tabucky or whoever was at the deep safety at the time, gets him and then ends up being a touchdown. It was one of those ugly losses we had on the road, and I think 0-1 or maybe 0-2 or 3, I think the 0-2 season between the Super Bowls out in San Diego. And it's just one of those classic moments that sticks out to me where he's definitely in that category of don't let this guy make you look stupid, you know. But there are other backs, I think, on this list that to even average linebackers, you don't worry about it that much necessarily. I mean, there's the guys that you're like, am I going to be able to touch this guy? You know, am I going to be? And again, as a special teams linebacker like myself, I'm used to covering the kick returners and punt returners, the guys that are crazy fast, the guys that are really hard to just get hands on. You're happy to get them down. You don't usually get the kill shots on those kinds of guys. And LT was similar to that, where he wasn't a, let's try to blow this guy up. It was like, let's try to touch him. You know, it's like one guy, get him and slow him down and get him dancing, and then we got to come in and blow him away. So I think he has like a, you know, once in a lifetime skill that's right there near Barry as far as making guys miss. He's maybe top 20 on some of the other attributes, where that slots him in overall, how you want to sort of net it out. I mean, that's, I guess that's up for debate, but it's good, I think, to include the guy in the list, because anytime I look down and see a guy that's played more than 10 seasons and he's, you know, he's missed one game in 2004, missed two games in 2009, and even one as an older player, you know, later with the Jets to the next year. So the point is, he put a lot of 16 game seasons together at a time when backs just weren't doing that. So productive, uniquely skilled, reserves a place on the list there somewhere.
So just to wrap this up, the Twitter followers of the Next Fan Up podcast voted 43% for Barry Sanders as the greatest back of all time. Walter Payton came in second at 27%, Jim Brown 25%, so right behind Walter Payton, and LaDainian Tomlinson only 5%, but I think we all agree he probably deserved a few more votes. Just, I mean, listen, we're talking about guys who are Hall of Famers. These are great running backs, period, but when we're trying to whittle it down to the greatest of all time, Barry Sanders came out on top. M-Dub, real quick, because I know you got to run. Tell us a little bit about your article there on todayspigskin.com.
Yeah, you know, you were hobbling around and late to the podcast today, so Matt and I were chatting a little bit about it, and I had the same conversation with Ross Tucker this morning on his podcast. You know, we were talking about my top 20 quarterback list, and we got to the running backs a little bit too, and we all had the same reaction. You know, when you see it on paper, there's not very many good running backs in the league right now. You know, like my top three were Le'Veon Bell, Peterson, and Gurley. And then I was like, who's next? And so I put Jamal Charles on the list, you know, but he was hurt all last year. What's he going to look like right now? And then I didn't know, who did we even put five? You know, I went with Doug Martin, and I don't even think he's that good. And, you know, there's the Ingrams and Stewarts and Devontae Freemans, and all those guys are top eight now running backs, and I don't think any of them are that good.
Are you knocking McCoy down because he had a down year?
I think he was 11 or so. I don't have the list in front of me, but
you have him at 12.
He's a little too finesse for my liking, and I worry about him a little bit that we've seen the best of him.
I have to say, I was surprised to see Deion Lewis on here. Even the homer in me can't agree to that.
I think this is kind of what Matt and I were talking about, where it's, I think the frustration is when you look down the list. I mean, when you're staring at the list of stats, you try to look for production. And in today's game, and again, I know a lot of these guys. I mean, you talked to like Thomas Jones, who was one of those good sort of grinded out backs, had a productive long career. He was definitely one of those guys who TJ would say, hey, man, you can't tell me what I would do because you never gave me the ball 30 times like all these other guys who compiled the stats. And if I'm, you know, I'm sitting here looking down the list, and, you know, what does Jonathan Stewart think? Well, Jonathan Stewart is one of the few guys on the list who actually gets the ball and plays in sort of a run-first offense. There aren't that many guys on this list beyond what you think of them that get the ball. So it makes it really tough to judge them. So it's really hard to get excited about any of them. I think the guys we tend to get a little more excited about are the guys like Le'Veon Bell or Charles or somebody that's getting it both ways. And you know, it's just a weird league that way now, where I think it'd be interesting, and these guys would argue, hey, man, well, I could do more if I lived in another era. You know, if I was even Darren McFadden playing in the 80s, you know, and Darren McFadden was playing in an I system and was just getting the ball 30, 35 times a game. Now, I think people that watched him over his career would wonder if he could stay healthy through all that, but just those guys that would fit that style, but nobody's playing that way anymore. So, you know, it's sort of like the car that's not being driven. Does it change what the car is? Well, in these kind of stat-based arguments, we kind of get stuck because there's not really much else to go off of. But I see a lot of guys on here who could do a hell of a lot more if it was just given to them.
And along those lines, my wide receiver list is coming out today. And there's a wealth to pick from. You know, I mean, there's so many good wide receivers in the league right now.
Right.
And we're not even going to touch on your quarterback list because you have the wrong guy at number one. And I will leave it
I didn't put
at that.
There.
No, and I'm surprised, you know, when Matt was talking about greatest quarterbacks of all time, and he mentioned his former teammate Brady, that he skipped right over Drew Bledsoe, the greatest quarterback ever to live on the face of the planet. And I do mean that seriously. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we have not come to a consensus on the greatest running back of all time. We will definitely not get into the greatest quarterback of all time because that is a long conversation. I think we can all agree, Jerry Rice, greatest wide receiver of all time.
No doubt.
Well, yes, he is, but same thing. I mean, and this is why he was the most productive receiver. He's probably the most durable human that's built like that that I've ever seen. But he caught balls every week from Joe Montana and Steve Young, you know, until those late years when he was weird other places. I think he is. I would never argue that he's not. But I think if you're one of those other guys that played at different places, even if you're Terrell Owens or shoot any guy, say, what if I played with those two quarterbacks for a 14-year stretch? What would I do? And so I'm saying if this often boils down to me, if I'm a cornerback and I had to line up across the guy, who's the guy that I wouldn't want to see on one Sunday? I know Jerry Rice is not the guy I'd want to see in my division because, you know, if I played for another team, I know he's going to be there for 20 years because he's a freak of nature. And he's really productive in there each and every weekend. We know he's using a lot of stick-ems, so the ball's going to, you know, catch. So all those kinds of things. But I think in the event of the receiver question, it's just why I don't like doing this in this particular sport, because you know why he caught so many balls? He played on an exceptional team. So, you know, it is what it is.
But along those lines, I really think the conversation in wide receiver is who's the second best ever, if you really want to have the conversation. And I wrote this article right after Calvin Johnson retired that I thought he might end up being that guy. I right now I think it's Randy Moss. And it's the same argument Matt said. It was, okay, would I rather, as a corner, line up against Calvin Johnson for 60 snaps or Chris Carter, Michael Irvin, or you know, whoever else is in the conversation? To me, Moss and Calvin are the two guys you do not want to line up against.
I'm guessing, Matt, but I think if you had that conversation with present-day wide receivers, as much sort of deep-seated respect the guys have for Jerry Rice just because he did it so long, he was so exceptional, I don't think there's a cornerback in the game that wouldn't put Randy first. I mean, he was a guy he scares the hell out of quarterbacks.
Do everything right and you're wrong.
Exactly. So it's just that, and to me, that's often the measure, because in his situation, it doesn't really matter who's throwing the ball. He's collecting them by just smoking, you know, breaking off the top of any defense. So, you know, it's two different ways to get to a similar end, but I think the players players will often hold him in much higher regard than however the numbers shook out at the end of the deal.
Although those Raider years are hard to forget when you're talking about all-time greats.
You're right, exactly.
M-Dub, where can people find you?
At Williamson NFL. I'm easy to find, dude. I'm busy. I'm everywhere. And good stuff, man. We'll have to do this again.
And Matt Chatham?
At my house until this thing heals. But please don't come find me. Please do not come find me there. What is my handle? Shouldn't people know that have some Twitter followers? At Chatham58 on Twitter. There you go. But footballbyfootball.com. But right now, go check out our archive stuff. We're not right in the off season, but there's still a lot of great content out there, and we'll get rolling again here as the season gets near.
Awesome. Thank you, Matt. Appreciate your knowledge. And back to the superfans. All right, so there we go. We've left it still sort of undecided. I suppose our listeners have made the final word. Barry Sanders is the greatest of all time, according to the Next Fan Up listeners. And honestly, that's all that matters. Next Fan Up listeners have had the final word. It's Barry Sanders. The two Matts, they still didn't agree. Matt Williamson still going with Jim Brown. Matt Chatham on the fence about Sanders or Walter Payton. They both agree that Walter Payton probably number two. So there's a little bit extra there. And we all agreed that LaDainian Tomlinson, sort of the guy that doesn't get enough pub about how great a running back he actually was.
Did you say Walter Payton one more time? I was just curious how you said the word Walter.
Walter Payton came in number two.
Oh, it sounded like you had quite an accent there. Just coming out a little bit.
Anybody else have an opinion? Let's see here. Justin and Neil, you guys were on the show. Rob, who, you know, OJ Simpson came up briefly last week when we were having this conversation. Any other opinions on the greatest running back of all time?
OJ looked great in some highlights I've seen of him. For me, it's been Barry Sanders, just because that's the best running back that I've physically, you know, seen, you know, for multiple games. And, you know, Jim Brown, I do have an affinity for him because he went to Syracuse. But, I mean, as far as running backs I've seen, to me, it's just Barry Sanders. He did things on the field that I've just never seen another running back do. To me, he's the best running back that I've seen with my two eyes, so I would vote for him.
And Davey, the Mats hammered away at Adrian Peterson, talking about his, I don't know if they really labeled it a lack of toughness, but just the ease of use it was to tackle Adrian Peterson and his boom or bustness. Anything to say about Adrian Peterson?
Yeah, I don't know. I just find that such an interesting criticism from people having watched him his whole career. I don't think he's the best running back of all time. I think he's one of the best pure runners of all time. The criticism I would have of him, though, has nothing to do with certainly far from having to do with being easy to go down. For a guy that has more after contact yards in one season than many of the other running backs had total, I think it's pretty crazy to think that this guy goes down easy. But anyway, I think his criticism is that he's a piss poor pass blocker. Guy can't block. He can't be on the field on third down. He's never really learned that, and I think it's because his ego's too big to think that, you know, he's not great at something. And to me, that's why someone like LaDainian Tomlinson's better. And you know, I don't know. I think there's always this weird bias for talking about the greatest of all time to lean old school, right? But I think if you were to put LT or even Adrian Peterson, I mean, these are all such impossible scenarios, but if you were to put them back, you know, with those guys playing, I think Peterson and LT would be outrageously better than them. They're playing with higher competition, more complicated game plans, and much, 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 much bigger defenders tackling them and still doing more with it. So I don't know. I mean, to me, it's always odd that no one's willing to say that the current guys or the new guys are the greatest ever, because they just don't want to, you know, believe that you're currently watching the best. And if I was going to pick one, I'm with them thinking that LT gets no love. I don't really get it. The guy did every aspect of the position of running back at the highest level for pretty much his whole career, and didn't drop off until he was what, like 32 or something. So I don't really quite get that.
So guys, nextfanup@gmail.com. That's the email address. That's how you can participate with us in these types of conversations. You all did a great job in voting on our Twitter polls at NFU Podcast on Twitter. But would have been great to have been including your voice as we discuss this. Nextfanup@gmail.com. That's the email address. Don't lose it. Send us an email and we'll talk about what it is that you got to say. And so we get to the cheating by the Baltimore Ravens, since a certain Baltimore Ravens superfan wanted to call things that are against the rules black and white, call it cheating. Ravens cheated. And the NFL believes the Baltimore Ravens were aware of non-contact practice rules at a recent minicamp, but still moved forward. And that is obviously going to lead to some more discipline down the road. Now, unfortunately, we had hoped our Seahawks superfan was going to be here, because the Seahawks got tagged with this not too long ago. Davey, did the Vikings get tagged with this at one point?
We've had our share of problems. I'm not sure this was one of them. It might have been. I've lost track.
Who knows at this point? But ultimately, the NFL is looking at this as a health and safety violation. I believe the Seahawks ended up losing a couple of practices. I think they lost almost like a week of preseason training camp due to the violation of the rules. So I would expect a similar ruling will come for the Baltimore Ravens. But it sort of brought up the whole crime and punishment in the NFL. And when we're talking crime and punishment in the NFL, you immediately think of the Patriots and you immediately think of Pat Siska, who has very many opinions on this topic.
I do. And it's funny how you just jump to the assumption that the discipline will be on par with what happened before, when what we've seen the last several years in pretty much every case is that it's completely arbitrary. It's like they're spinning a wheel to figure out what kind of draconian punishments to levy for pretty innocuous offenses like this one. So, I mean, we'll see. We'll see. It could be nothing. It could be a verbal warning. Or it could be like the loss of multiple draft picks, and who knows? It's kind of the Wild West over here.
To further flesh this out, teams are not allowed to suit up in full pads until training camp. Off-season rules have been more strict since 2011, when the latest CBA was passed. According to ESPN's Jameson Hensley, a Ravens source told him earlier the week that the team believed rookie minicamp didn't fall under the same rules as the OTAs. And so if we look at that, Pat, and I will call you out on this because you are the one that likes to point this out every time we bring up the filming scandal with the Patriots, is that it's sort of a matter of semantics. The Patriots filmed in an area where they were told not to film. And so that's what led to the whole filming scandal.
Yeah, sort of. They were told to film with a roof over their head, and there wasn't one. But let's not conflate the issues, right? So,
or deflate the issues? Sorry.
You're killing me. You're killing me. I'm trying to stay on topic. But the the defense of the Ravens here is one that I pretty strongly agree with, is that, you know, you can't have both strict adherence to rules and ambiguity in the rules, right? So if you want to say that there's you know, a difference between the different types of practices, cool, then there is. And you want to have different rule sets for those different types of practices, okay, then do that. But then you can't apply rules that are defined for one set of practices against a different set of practices. It's silly, right? That's like giving somebody a ticket for a failure to come to a complete stop sign in a parking space where there is no stop sign. It's like, it's completely different. So I don't know, man, like the NFL thing is, it's starting to boggle my mind, because the logical part of me says that, you know, what they're trying to do with, you know, the Patriots in particular, Tom Brady specifically, is they're trying to beat up a really visible figure on something that is completely benign, beyond his control, doesn't even fall into the rule book of a player, only for the team. And it's the whole thing is completely ridiculous, but it presses the issue in the next CBA, and like, what's that, like 5 years, that this then becomes a negotiating point to say, like, hey, like, we want 18 games. You want Roger Goodell to lose this power. I think those are fair. Let's make a trade. Right, and they can undercut the leverage that the players have in doing that by giving them something that's stupid and that nobody wants, because it makes the whole NFL look stupid, right? But giving it to the players as a, you know, in concession of something else that they want more. I get that. But what is this nonsense with the Ravens doing to progress that forward? Like, nothing, right? Just punishing the team, right? Which is part of this coalition that the NFL is supposed to be. So that leads us back to, like, is this really an organization? Is the NFL really its own entity? Or is it a loose coalition of teams that each one of which has equal weight in theory, and they get to bully each other around a bit because that's kind of what they do? He's trying to represent that he has sole authority in decision-making, you know, when in fact that's not really the case, right? So this whole thing is just pointing out how ridiculous and confusing this whole situation is when you expand it past the individual teams and players involved.
As Pat tries to find a quieter spot in the hurricane that is apparently hitting Boston, Davey, I know that you have a few opinions on this topic as well.
Yeah, I tend to just look at it a little more simply. I mean, as much as I like to poke fun on Slack at Patrick just to get him riled up when I'm bored and get some arguments flowing, I do agree with a lot of what he just said. I think that he's, you know, right on target with most of it. But what I think is mostly, you know, the reason that it's maybe not as confusing as you were trying to make it, or as you did make it sound, Patrick, is that, you know, they have these rules in place for a reason, and they keep on pushing these, right? They're trying to push player safety. And for the Ravens breaking that rule, I think that it is technically cheating because you're breaking a rule, but it's so you have to punish him, right? And the level of punishment, like you said, is all out of whack, and there's all these problems with it, and that's the part that they need to figure out. But to me, it doesn't seem that crazy that they're, you know, that they'd be getting in trouble for this. It doesn't seem that crazy that, you know, they're moving forward with this. You know, I've said lots of times the Vikings have done plenty of stuff wrong that they've gotten in trouble for and probably should get in trouble for more. So I don't know. I mean, to me, it seems more black and white to just, you know, follow the rule book and don't read so much into semantics, right? Like the whole Spygate thing. Yes, you can argue semantics all day, but the rule was broken. The rule was broken. And that's kind of what it just comes down to.
So here's the thing, Davey. Like if it were black and white, we wouldn't be talking about it, right? So if there were a rule book with a list of rules and, you know, penalties for violating those rules, then this would be dull and no one would even be paying attention to it. No one would be assuming that a hammer is going to come down on Baltimore for this, right? Because it would be some silly little offense that would carry like a $10,000 fine, and who cares, right?
Sure,
we fundamentally lost faith. Yes, that's what I'm saying. And a month ago,
no, I agree.
A month ago, it was said, you can't do that. You can't just arbitrarily levy penalties against people when there are known rules and known penalties associated with violating them, right? Like, and that makes sense. That is a justice system. That is a justice system, and anybody can buy into that. And that's the way things used to be in the NFL, and it's not the way they are now. And that's why people are saying, like, WTF.
So I agree completely. I don't think that the confusion is that the rules are broken or not broken. It's all in the punishment aspect of it, right? And that's what they need to sort out. And I don't disagree with you that it's confusing.
And I would also say that
they obviously have a ton of problems with it.
Clearly. And if that weren't the case, if the penalties weren't just completely arbitrary, I doubt you would even hear a defense from Baltimore. Like, I doubt they would be trying to mount one.
And that might be true.
But they kind of have to.
And that might be true. The biggest thing, though, that I think we probably differ on is I don't believe necessarily that because the punishments have seemed arbitrary that they're necessarily wrong because they're harsh. I think a lot of the idea of getting harsher is not necessarily a bad thing for the NFL, but they have to do it in a better way. I totally agree with you that it is arbitrary and they need to do a better job of getting to that point. They can't just randomly drop the hammer on. I mean, they did it to my guy too, Peterson. Now, I've been on the record many times saying he should very much have been punished for what he did, and I have no problem with it. But it does. It was pretty much random, the same way the randomness was with Ray Rice, with Tom Brady, with anybody, right? So all of these have been off the rail.
Well, here's the thing, I'm going to take an unpopular position here for just a second, because I've also been on this podcast saying that they should have hung Peterson from a yardarm, right? Because it's one of the most respectable things.
Yeah, we finally agree on some stuff, Patrick. We finally agree.
Yeah, there we go. But I will say this: punishing a guy severely for beating his kids is the obligation of the state, not the NFL, right? So if this guy shouldn't be walking around, like, don't put that on Roger Goodell. Put that on the people of Minnesota, that's where it happened. But, go to the state of Texas and be like, hey, like, put this MF-er in jail where he belongs, right? And then it's not really
an
issue whether or not he's playing football. Well, they probably would. But, let's scrutinize that, right? And if you take that obligation away from the NFL to try and literally police the behavior of their players when they're not on the field, and you put it back in the court systems where it belongs, then Adrian Peterson isn't an issue anymore. Neither is Ray Rice, right? Neither is any other off-field violation that's going to tarnish the shield. It's like, no. Like, if somebody breaks a law, put them in jail. If you're not going to put them in jail, look to the legislature, because that's where the problem is. But anyway, again, I'm way off
topic. To an extent, though, right? Because that kind of goes back to the cheating thing, because there's a code of conduct that lots of workplaces have. I mean, you can't do certain things at lots of, you know, name any workplace. There's, you know, that's what they're leaning on here. And it all just keeps boiling back to the fact that they have no idea how to make a consistent punishment. And even more, if you dial it back even further, it goes back to the fact that when these things started happening, they were punishing it too soft and nobody used to care. And now people care a lot. So when something like Ray Rice happens, they overcompensate. Then when something like, you know, the Deflategate crap and all the Spygate stuff happens, they again overcompensate, right? I certainly do think that they probably cheated, but I also think that the punishment has been sort of outrageous and sort of hilariously large. Like, come on. Like, a couple of Vikings players got caught with steroids on the defensive line. That's definitely a bigger deal than the deflating of football. But it wasn't nearly the big deal that we're seeing right now. So they clearly have no idea how to escalate it.
It wasn't a case that had the potential of going to the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
I think it did. I think it would have, except they retired eventually.
Right. That's exactly what happened. At least the Saints players involved in it, I think so.
Hold on. You guys have spoken enough. It's time for Pod Vader to take control. To go along with all of this, the NFL has also named a new vice president of policy and rules administration, that being the former offensive lineman John Runyan, who was drafted by the Oilers. He played 207 games in his 14-year NFL career with Houston, Tennessee, Philadelphia, and San Diego. He was also elected to the U.S. House of Representatives for New Jersey after his playing career was done, served from 2011 to 2015. Now he will oversee club and game-related initiatives related to players. He will serve as Commissioner Goodell's designee for on-field discipline as agreed upon by the NFL and NFLPA in Article 46 of the Collective Bargaining Agreement. And yes, I'm reading this directly from the NFL Communications press release. Now we'll have a guy who was an offensive lineman, whom I question how much does an offensive lineman know about the big hits on the football field, but was also a politician at one point. It's an interesting conflation of things happening as the NFL is trying to clean up their crime and punishment squad.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to pretend to know his background very well because I certainly don't, but if he was a politician, he certainly understands the need to be able to walk a fine line and not just go spraying around, you know, random statements, punishments, whatever, willy-nilly, right? Like, he's going to understand having a little bit more finesse, which might be the solution here. And I don't think that this can't
David,
be a
that's
bad
your view of politics. You don't
well,
think
don't
politicians
think
react like
no, they certainly
in
react. They certainly react, but I think that they react with some sort of plan. They don't just go. For instance, what you just described Goodell doing with all of these recent punishments, it's even hard to understand where they come from, right? If you bring a guy in that is at least a third party that has somewhere he's been somewhere else, he has a different experience, you know. From the political background of wanting to be able to please both sides, he understands the aspect of wanting to please both sides. I'm not saying they're always good at that, but at least he is, you know, experienced in giving that a good shot. I don't know.
Rob and Neil, you two have been. Rob and Neil, you guys have been quiet on this. Rob, you have any thoughts on this topic?
I mean, I don't have too many thoughts on it. I wasn't too familiar with his, obviously as familiar with him as an NFL player. I'm actually just right now looking at some stuff on his time of his political career. And I mean, he's definitely, as far as his personality, definitely a go-getter because he quit after 4 years because he's, according to him, he's just working with too many people with agendas that didn't, the people weren't trying to get stuff done. So, I mean, I don't know. I mean, he seems like the ambitious type. It seems like something that he would be able to do well at. But, I mean, I don't really know too much about, you know, what he's done. So
I'm going to read too much into what you just said, and it sounds like he likes to shoot from the hip. Because if he didn't have enough patience to get legislature through because he was anxious to get stuff done, that sounds a lot like more Roger Goodell than I'd like to see in this position.
Yeah, Yeah, if that's true, then that's not helping much.
Neil, jump in.
I don't have a lot to say. Yeah, I don't have a lot to say about John Runyon, good player and all that. I can't really comment on your legislative system. However, there's a few things. I think I generally agree with what's been said so far. I think the arbitrariness of the punishments that are that are levied to NFL players and teams has to change. There has to be some working together with the union and with the NFL and try and get a little bit more of a sort of menu of punishments. Do this, you get this sort of system. Just simplified, I think. And I would say, I come from a country where in rugby, which is, you know, one of our tougher sports, if somebody punches somebody in the football field, then on the rugby field, then they usually get banned for 12 games. And believe it or not, you'll be rather surprised to hear they don't do that again. I would like to see tougher punishments in the NFL, because I think the NFL was extraordinarily soft when it comes to punishments. And just going to this Baltimore Ravens outrageous act of cheating, I think forget them wearing pads, making the players wear pads. They should just be fined and, I don't know, lose draft picks from the simple fact of if you're going to cheat, make it worthwhile. This is probably the dumbest things they could do. What effect is this going to have on them winning a Super Bowl? Absolutely nothing. It's totally ridiculous. Plus, the sessions are videotaped, and everybody's wearing pads, which is a bit of a giveaway. So just for being completely dumb, I would give them a rather large suspension.
By the way, just to go back to the Seahawks, their first practice gate was in 2012. They were fined an undisclosed amount, stripped of two OTS practices, and then they foolishly did it again in 2014. Pete Carroll was fined $100,000. Seahawks were fined $200,000, and they lost two double practices in 2015. Congratulations.
What is $100,000 to a team or a coach? I mean, $100,000, it's nothing. It's like you and I getting fined $20 or in my case, £20. It's nothing. You know, if you're going to fine them properly and something in line with their earnings. It's ridiculous. He probably had it in his back pocket and just said, oh, yeah, here you go.
Well, the positive thing is all that money gets put into a charity pool and does ultimately end up in good hands.
There is such a thing as a small fine. Like, like, not everything needs to be the end of the organization as we know it, right?
Especially for making football players wear pads. Oh, my gosh.
In the hot days, Pod, like, it's like, it's got to be 68 degrees over there right now. Like that's a little too toasty to be in pads.
What were we thinking? Players were wearing pads.
To be fair, it wasn't that long ago that a Vikings player died because of heat stroke on this type of problem.
Yeah, wasn't that like 18 years ago?
It was probably where this rule came from is all I'm saying.
Yep. That's true.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think there was any risk of heat stroke in this particular moment. But in any case, we'll see what happens with the Ravens. That's going to do it for today's show, everybody. Listen, Sunday evening, 8 p.m. Eastern, go to podcastawards.com. Find out if our show gets nominated for Best in Sports. We will find out, and then we'll need your help to actually win the award. So stay tuned in. We'll let you know if we're nominated, and then if we are, how to vote for us and all that good stuff. Podcastawards.com, Sunday evening, 8 p.m. Eastern. I want to thank the two Matts, Matt Chatham, Matt Williamson, for joining us, sort of closing the book on the greatest running back of all time conversation. I want to thank all the super fans here. We got Davey, the Viking super fan, Patrick, the Patriot super fan, Rob, the Bill super fan, and Neil, the Redskins super fan. Go and leave us a review on iTunes. You can subscribe there. You can also, remember, download that app, the AHA radio app. If you don't have an iTunes device, such as an iPod or an iPhone, you've got an Android phone or a Google phone, go get the AHA radio app and find the next Fan Up podcast via that app. Thanks to everyone. I'm going to sign off, as I always do, with Jeff Fisher. There you have it.
Well, I think we learned today that, you know, this game is four quarters long.
Great stuff this week. Yes.
Yeah, you don't say goodbye to Justin in your final closing from earlier on.
Oh, I don't. Do I?
That's probably for the best.